Today's Teisho will be on case 32 in the Mumon Kan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 32 is as follows. A non-Buddhist philosopher questions the Buddha. A non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddha, I do not ask for words, I do not ask for non-words. The Buddha just sat there. The philosopher said admiringly, the world-honored one with his great mercy has blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the way. After making bows, he took his leave. Then Ananda asked the Buddha, what did he realize to admire you so much? The world-honored one replied, a fine horse runs even at the shadow of the riding crop. Mumon's comment, Ananda was the Buddha's disciple, but his understanding was not equal to that of the non-Buddhist. I want to ask you, what difference is there between the Buddha's disciple and the non-Buddhist? Mumon's verse, on the edge of the sword, over the ridge of an iceberg, with no steps, no ladders, climbing the cliffs without hands, so I want to thank everybody for coming here, either in person or online, and sitting so well, really deep, deep samadhi in our physical room and our virtual room. Really wonderful to see. That kind of sitting is priceless and actually quite rare to have people sit with this kind of intensity for many hours. Really, really wonderful and completely liberating. Totally liberating. So thank you. Thank you for being here and contributing to the collective energy of our practice. So, this Teisho involves an encounter between the Buddha and a non-Buddhist philosopher. There were, in the Buddhist time, many different schools of thinking. And there was actually an intense competition among the different schools. So there were people who were basically like materialists, right? They thought the only thing that exists is the material world, and you know, you live and you die, and that's it, and your body decomposes. There were nihilists, you know, and nothing has value. There were eternalists. There were people who said, you know, when you die, your soul is immortal, you know, and it continues forever. There were so many different schools at the time, and Buddhism was actually just one of them. In this case, a member of one of those non-Buddhist schools meets the world-honored one, and they have this encounter that's described here. In the Pali Sutras, there's a number of encounters between the Buddha and non-Buddhists, but non-Buddhist-like philosophers or participants in other non-Buddhist schools. And they're interesting to read because sometimes they will challenge the Buddha. You know, they'll ask him a question in a challenging spirit. Occasionally, they're rude to him, right? And it's interesting to see how he responds to that rudeness. It's really very inspiring. You know, according to the sutras, he never gets angry. He's always polite. He may ask somebody, "Why are you being so rude?" You know, but always calm and compassionate. Very, very good model for all of us. In this case, he meets a non-Buddhist philosopher, says to him, seeks him out, and says, I don't ask for words, and I don't ask for non-words. And it says the Buddha just sat there, and then the philosopher said admiringly, well, you have blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the way. And so Ananda asks him, what was that all about, right? And the Buddha says, you know, a fine horse doesn't have to be hit with a riding crop. It just sees the shadow of the riding crop and it runs faster. Okay. So the Buddha, as I've mentioned before, was trained to be like a military leader. So sometimes his metaphors are taken from his training. So sometimes he'll speak about like shooting arrows into a target and hitting the mark, right? And at other times he'll talk about some other aspect of Indian martial arts. And here he's talking about striking a horse with a riding crop. Please don't strike any horses with a riding crop, but that was his training. And he's saying a fine horse doesn't have to be struck. Just seeing the riding crop makes him run faster. That's the idea. So you know, it's an interesting question about what it means to be a Buddhist, right? You know, there are many different schools of Buddhism. Often they're organized into three great families. So there's the Theravada Buddhist. That Theravada means the way of the elders. So Buddhists in Sri Lanka and Thailand and Burma, Laos, they often wear ochre robes and they live very austere lives, and they basically rely on the Pali Sutras and the commentaries on the Pali Sutras, and those are known as followers of the way of the elders. There's also the Buddhism of, you could say, China, which includes Chan or Zen, and also Pure Land Buddhism. But actually there are a number of different schools that are often put by scholars under the umbrella of East Asian Buddhism, right? So Chan and Pure Land are the most well-known representatives, but there's a Yogacara school, actually. And there is, there's a Huayan school. Many different sutras have produced different schools. And then there's the Tibetan Buddhist family of traditions. And the Dalai Lama is just one representative. You know, within Tibetan Buddhism, there's the Nyingma, there's the Gelugpa, which is the Dalai Lama school. There are a number of other traditions, the Jonangpa. We could go on and on. So, it's actually very interesting that, you know, if you start talking about Buddhism, you very soon might find yourself asking which Buddhism. And in fact, the Buddhisms that are around today are not the only Buddhisms that ever existed. There are many, many schools of Buddhism, and some of them have completely disappeared, and some of them have continued, but they don't go by the same name anymore. It's really, if you get into Buddhist history, you may or may not find any of this interesting. But, you know, actually, all the South Asian traditions come out of this Theravada school, but there was another school of Indian Buddhists called the Dharmaguptaka school. And believe it or not, Zen and East Asian Buddhism actually belongs to the Dharmaguptaka school. Believe it or not, we're all part of the Dharmaguptaka. You probably didn't know that, right? But it was one of the Indian schools of Buddhism that spread into Central Asia. It went up. It got as far as Iran, you know, and then it went into China. And even today, if you're a Chinese monk or nun, you're ordained. You take Dharmaguptaka ordination vows, you know. So actually, if you start studying Buddhism, it becomes really complicated, right? And even in the Theravada is one group, and then there's the other group, generally speaking, is called the Mahayana, the Great Way. But even within the Mahayana, there are disagreements. So, you know, within the Mahayana, there's a school called the Yogacara school, which Zen is very much a part of, right? That's the school that's interested in the power of the unconscious mind. But there's also a school which, you know, basically is interested in pure emptiness, emptiness, right? So even within a group of, say, Mahayana monks or nuns, you know, or specialists, you might have debates, right? You know, how much of this goes into the mix and how much of this goes into the mix? And as you know, in Zen, we have lineages also, right? So, you know, our lineage in Zen is supposed to go back to Shakyamuni, and Shakyamuni passed the Dharma on, we say, to one person, and then it went on to another person, and went on to another person, and there's a Dharma, the Indian ancestors, and then it goes to Bodhidharma coming to China, and then there's six Chinese ancestors, and then Wei Nang, and then, you know, then there's Lin Ji, and so very quickly, you know, the question of what it means to be a Buddhist is actually a little confusing, right? So if you begin to look at Buddhism, you know, you find that there's not really one Buddhism. And this is, I think, really instructive and important, because, you know, we all, when I first started reading books on Buddhism, I was really deeply, powerfully moved. And it wasn't long before I bought a little Buddha, you know. I had a little Buddha, and I kept it on my desk next to my typewriter. Some of you might still know what a typewriter is. I would look at it, and when I would meditate, I got some incense at Shiga's import store in Seattle, and I lit my little incense next to my little Buddha, and I started putting down, you know, when I had to fill in forms, like medical forms, it would say religion, and I would think, Buddhism, I'm a Buddhist, you know, and I think, God, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a Buddhist. And it was actually kind of exciting, you know, to be a Buddhist. Very exciting. And, you could say it became part of my identity. When I began to study Buddhism, though, I realized that, you know, it's very difficult to say what a Buddhist is and what a Buddhist isn't. You know, in Japan, you know, actually, monks are allowed to marry. So this is like very unusual in the Buddhist world. In some Tibetan schools as well, monks are allowed to marry. But in Japan, is like they went through some modernizing reforms in the 19th century, and one of the things that they did was to allow monks and nuns, actually just monks, not nuns, it was sexist. They allowed monks to get married. So in Japan, lots of monks are married. They have families in the temple. You know, you can go to visit a monk. You can go to visit Daitokuji, and you'll go in and you'll meet the head priest, and then you'll meet his wife, and his kids are playing in the yard. In most of the Buddhist world, Japanese monks are not allowed to ride in the special train cars for Buddhist priests. They have to sit with the lay people because they're not acknowledged as real priests because they are married, see. So there's a lot of this. it's also the case that, you know, so being a Buddhist, you know, is an interesting thing. You know, it's an identity, and it's expresses commitment to something, right? But when we begin to ask what it expresses commitment to, you know, very quickly it all becomes confusing. And I have often thought that the essence of what we're doing is really not about finding an identity at all, right? You know, one of the things that really attracted me to Buddhism was that I was under a lot of pressure in graduate school to be smarter than I really am, you know. And I had lots of anguish about, you know, my ability to be effective as a graduate student and maybe even as a English professor. And I would go to these classes, and you know, I'm teaching right now this novel, this wonderful novel, Middlemarch by George Eliot. And I remember taking Dick Dunn's course on the novel when I was a graduate student at the University of Washington. And you know, George Eliot actually translated a lot of stuff from German. And she was one of the intellectuals of her time, leading intellectuals of her time. She taught herself German, self-educated person. She went to Germany, she came back, and she translated like all these German philosophers. So before she became famous as a novelist, she was famous as a translator. And, you know, in this class, we would start talking about Hegel. And there were people in the class who had really like read Hegel. And I tried to understand Hegel, but it was so hard to understand. And some of these people had read it in German. They'd say, as Hegel said, blah, 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 blah. And I would come home and I would just think, oh my God, you know, maybe I could get my warehouse job back at the Mayflower Moving Company. You know, and then I would go to sit at the Zen Center and, you know, I would be racked by insecurity and self-doubt. And I would go to the Zen Center and I would sit down on the cushion, and all of that would just dissipate. It would just be gone. You know, and you start watching your breath, and you know, your mind begins to empty of thought. And all of a sudden, it's like your mind is sort of like this emptiness. And you hear the sounds around you, you feel the cold on your face. You know, at the Zen Center, Geki Roshi always used to open the window every morning. So in the winter, it was just freezing cold. So I'd be bundled up and I'd feel that cold hit my face, you know. But, you know, after an hour and a half of that, I felt so liberated. All of that conversation in my head, all of that self-censoring and self-doubt and lacerating self-criticism, all of that went away. And I was really, I felt really free. And I'm so happy that I discovered this path, because, you know, early on it teaches you something really important, you know, which is that this path is not about being a Buddhist, right? Now, let me just say, when I still have to fill in forms, you know, if I go into the hospital or something, medical forms, and they say, what's your religion? I still write Buddhist, you know. But, you know, to be a Buddhist is a really interesting thing. You know, you can be a Gelugpa Buddhist, you can be a Theravada Buddhist, you can be a Sanlung school Buddhist. You can be a Wahyan Buddhist. But you know, actually, I think we would all agree that, you know, what's really important, whether we're practicing Nyenfo, or that is reciting lines from a sutra, or Zazen, you know, sitting on the cushion for many hours. You know, what happens is that, you know, we are in this realm where the self is so important, After a while, we stop being in that realm. And the, little by little, the self-referencing stops. And it's like we're ascending to a higher level. And in that place, there's like no, the question of the self stops being a relevant question. And it's like consciousness, we enter the realm of consciousness without a, thoughts without a thinker, consciousness without a thinker. And that experience, I think, is what, you know, even though I had so many pressures, you know, I had, it just kept me coming back to the cushion, because that's really liberation, that, in my opinion. That's really transcendence, right? Transcendence. And that experience of, like, life beyond the self, or beyond identity, right, is so, I have just found it to be the most wonderful thing in my life, right? The most wonderful, but beyond, really beyond compare, nothing is like that, you know? And there are many different aspects or levels of selfless, of consciousness without a thinker, of thoughts without a thinker, of consciousness without an without an object and without a subject, right? It's just pure consciousness. You know, you, when you hear a bird, you become the bird. You don't even think necessarily, I am the bird, or you might, but first you become the bird, and then you think, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm the bird. So this is a deeply transformative experience, and it's profoundly liberating. And, you know, if you go there often enough, it has a tremendously transformative effect on every aspect of your life. We are so identified, you know, our culture conditions us, and maybe all cultures condition us, to be profoundly identified with and invested in our identities. To be a self is something we don't actually choose, it's imposed on us. And it's not just any self, it's, you know, it's the self that our parents chose for us, or our society chose for us. And, you know, even, and so much of our culture is about, having a self that you can like or respect or feel good about. And very little of our culture encourages people to forget the self. So even now, if you go to the few remaining bookstores that exist, you know, you will see that there's a self-help section in the bookstore. And often the Buddhism books are there. In fact, somebody I know, a person I don't know personally, but whose work I respect, he has a new book coming out. And I noticed on the cover, it says it's in the self-help section of the, you know, it's one of the, they give books, typologies, right? So if it's history, they put it in with the history books. If it's you know, anthropology, and this is put in the self-help section. And you know, I would just like to say that Buddhism doesn't belong in the self-help section, even though that's where it often winds up, because, you know, the way to help yourself is to forget yourself, according to Buddhism, Buddhist tradition. You know, as Dogen said, Dogen Zenji said, you know, to practice Zen is to study the self. Yes. But then he says, to study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to become one with the 10,000 things. So this is really the key, right? You know, forgetting the self and becoming one with the 10,000 things. And I think this is the essence of Buddhism, right? So whether you happen to be a Theravada practitioner, or a Mahayanist, or a follower of the Dalai Lama, or one of the Karma Kagyu, or one of the other schools of Tibetan Buddhism, you know, Buddhism is all about you know, I think of Buddhism as being like, well, you know, the Buddha compared the Dharma to a ladder. And he said, you know, you when you climb up, use the ladder to climb up. Once you've climbed up, you don't need the ladder anymore. You know? So the particular ideas that got you to that place are not really that important. Right? It's getting to that place, that selfless place. Another metaphor the Buddha commonly used was the Dharma is a raft. And he said, you know, my teaching is like a raft that carries you to the other shore. And he says, once you get to the other shore, you don't need the raft anymore. And when he was talking about the other shore, he wasn't talking about like heaven in a Western sense. He was talking about the heaven we all enter. And I think it's the best heaven of all, if I may say so. The heaven we all enter when we forget the self. You know, sitting on the cushion is a little bit like climbing a ladder, right? You know, you take it one step at a time. You know, it's just hard to calm the mind down. And then you're in that stream of thinking. And then the thoughts become fewer and farther between, and at some point you stop self-referencing so much. And now you're entering this consciousness without a subject and an object. And it's like this, it's like the sky. It's like the Chinese Buddhists compare it to like the Lantian, the blue sky. You know, it's like being down in a valley, and there's thick clouds and smoke and dirt in the street, you know, and then you climb up this mountain and you get to the top, and above the clouds you can see the blue sky in all directions, right? And basically, you know, the particular raft that gets us there, the particular ladder we climb up, is not so important. You know, so you know, you may or may not be a follower of the Madhyamaka school, which says, you know, everything is empty, basically. And I consider myself much closer to the Yogacara school, which talks about the Buddha nature, our intrinsic Buddha nature. But, you know, I have met people who are very much in the Yogacara school and people who are very much in the Madhyamaka school, and they all understand where we're going. So all of this is just skillful means. These are just skillful means to help us get to the other shore. And liberation is this wonderful state. So I think all of this is, you know, extremely useful, especially right now, because, you know, identity is the cause of so much suffering in the world. You know, if you think about it, right now, you know, we're looking at this conflict in the Middle East, and you have Israelis, and Palestinians. And, you know, basically this is a conflict between people. But, you know, behind that there's a conflict between, like, identities, right? Really, it's like cultures and histories and identities. And, you know, so many of our conflicts are like this, right? It's like internalize or cling to a particular identity. And that becomes, in a certain way, like this wonderful rock that we can stand on and feel firmly planted in the shifting terrain of the world, right? You know, so life is so uncertain, And, you know, it's so confusing. You know, to be able to say, I am this, you know, it's like, I am this, is you know, I'm a Buddhist. So wonderful to say, I'm a Buddhist. And if you look at Buddhism, it's 2,500 years old. It has an incredibly complicated and interesting history. You know, have you ever wondered why Theravada monks wear ochre robes and Tibetans wear, burgundy-colored robes, and Zen people wear blue robes, or now yellow robes? You know, have you ever wondered about this? You know, actually, for a long time in China, monks and nuns weren't allowed to wear yellow robes because yellow was the color, the emperor's color. So eventually it became common for people to wear black or navy blue robes. And that's still the case in Japan. But, you know, after, you know, in the modern world, Chinese have all, they mostly wear yellow robes or golden robes, right? Because there's no emperor anymore, they can get away with it. So you know, fascinating, right? But it would be a pity to be too attached to the color of one's robe. And, you know, it would be a pity to be too attached to the fact that one Buddhist is Theravada and another Buddhist is Chan and another Buddhist is Yogacara. That would be quite foolish, right? When these are all just ladders we use to climb up, or rafts we use to go to the other shore. And the other shore is not to be a true Buddhist in every pore of your body, but to be free from all identity. Right? Identity is not true, you know, from the Buddhist standpoint. Identities are conditional. They're like rafts. You know, so look, I'm Kurt. You know, I was born in Philadelphia. And I was born in 1954 in Philadelphia. You know, at some point, I'm not going to be Kurt anymore. I think you can bet on that. Hopefully not. You know, the transition won't be next year, but it will happen, right? And, you know, from the Buddhist standpoint, Kurt is just like a room I'm staying in right now, right? It's just like I'm in a hotel for a little while, and it's called the Kurt Hotel. And, you know, this is not really metaphorical. You know, the more you go to that place where you no longer self-reference, the more you sort of like identify with the non-self pure consciousness that has no beginning and no end. And you kind of realize that all the things that happened in your life happened, but they, in a certain way, they didn't happen to you. You know, isn't that, that's a strange way to put it, isn't it? But it's like, you know, when you're working through your obstacles on the cushion, you know, maybe your father and mother loved your brother more than they loved you, and you're working on a koan, and all of this comes up in the koan, and you feel the old sadness and sense of, you know, unworthiness, blah, blah, blah. Eventually, you know, you work all that through on the cushion. You go into emptiness, and then you realize that just happened. You know, it's no longer triggering any kind of response. It just happened. You know, people may or may not have meant you harm, but it just happened. You know, it's like a process, right? It's just the unfolding of causes and effects. No. And as long as you think of causes and effects as happening to you, they cause you pain. But when you realize they're not really happening to you, they're just happening. And the you is like a little story you invented. Once you realize that, actually, it's far from being frightening, it's so liberating, it's so enabling. And this happens to us in Zen practice all the time. Something that was so traumatizing, and it's like this heavy weight just dissolves, right? Things are happening, right? Things just happen. And they happen because other things happened before them. This is like cause and effect. And we take it personally, but when we stop taking it personally, everything is transformed, right? So you know, to be a Buddhist is like a raft or a ladder. It's a skillful means. It's a kind of, it's something like an identity, but you know, the purpose of that identity is to take you outside or beyond identity. And you know, basically we could make distinctions between a Buddhist and a non-Buddhist, right? You're not a Buddhist, you know, I'm a Buddhist. And you know, kind of what's going on in this koan is that a non-Buddhist, you have all these Buddhists, you know, all these followers of the Buddha. And you have thousands of them by now, and monks and nuns and this sangha with, you know, all of these traditions, and this person doesn't belong to that. And he comes to meet the Buddha, and it's not the Buddha's teaching that sets him free, it's the Buddha's silence that sets him free. The Buddha shows him the blue sky of mind beyond all ideas and identities. And in that blue sky of mind, it doesn't matter what you call yourself, because none of that is real. None of that is real. And I think this is, you know, this is such a good teaching for our time, where identity is so extraordinarily, causes so much extraordinary suffering. Right? You know, I realize that identity is important, right? So, you know, just the other day I was reading another article on these Native Americans out west who were taken from their families, and they were forced into these boarding schools, and they weren't allowed to speak their native languages. And, you know, there was a real attempt to exterminate their culture. And, you know, of course, all of this came out, has come out like 100 years later, all the abuse and really terrible, terrible. It's an awful experience. And, you know, what they're trying to do is to reconstruct their culture. So they're still like native speakers of their language, and they're trying to go back and learn the language. They're all learning these languages that these teachers 50 years ago would hit them for speaking. And they're in their trying to revive some of their ceremonies. And I think this is wonderful. I think it's so important for people to do this. And they were, you know, done in extraordinary violence, you know, by these people who claim to be helping them. So yeah, identity is important, right? It plays this role, you know, when they revive their language, when they revive their mythologies, you know, their religious beliefs and their ceremonies. You know, you can go to, you know, I remember I had a friend out in Seattle. His name was William Black Elk. He was like, if you know anything about Native American history, Black Elk was this great 20th, late 19th century shaman, right? And William Black Elk was his like great grandson or something, and he became my friend. He wound up in an English class, and I had him as this. I was his teacher, you know. And later we became friends, and he had been through some of these things, but you know, he told me about going to powwows, right? You know, they would all get together, and you know, they have this musical tradition and dancing, and he just said it was so sustaining, right? So sustaining. So you know, culture is really necessary and important. I agree. And you know, people have to, people need culture. It's their collective and personal memory, and it has all these wonderful functions. But I don't have to tell you that it has a dangerous aspect too, right? Because, you know, it's also about creating a kind of boundary between us and them, us and them. And it's the pleasures of being in us are often tied in with the dangers of excluding others. I hope I'm making some sense, right? I mean, it was definitely the case that, you know, Native Americans would, you know, different tribes would attack each other and so on, kill members of the other tribe. So there's something wonderful about being Nez Perce, right? But there's also something, you know, if you ask a neighboring tribe, maybe they have bad feel, you know, bad. There's a limit to what identity can do, and identity, I think, becomes dangerous at a certain point. You know, nobody has the right to take away your identity, your history, and your language. But, you know, once we have those things, I think we begin to feel their limitations, right? Once you recover the old language, you know, and once you have the ceremonies, you know, it's possible to begin to experience things in a different way, right? You know, I think that whatever the ceremony, you know, sometimes the ceremony itself lifts us to that level where, you know, the words are no longer important, you know. The words are no longer important. It's no longer important who's reciting the words, right? We're taken to a place beyond language and beyond identity. So I think it's really important for us to respect people's identities and their histories. But I think Buddhism has like this really important message, you know, which these things become toxic when they don't take us beyond, you know, identities become toxic when they don't help us to move beyond identity. And, you know, when we, when our identities require us to draw a line between ourselves and other people, that's where we need to be worried. Right, we need to be worried. And that's what we see happening all over the world, right? I think that this experience, this Buddhist experience of emptiness, is so valuable because it's really not an experience that many people have, they may have, but they don't necessarily appreciate it. You know, the worse things become sometimes, the more I cling to my identity. But clinging to your identity is really dangerous because it involves you in I would say that the more you cling to your identity, I hate to say this, but the more you cling to your identity, the smaller your world is going to become. First of all, you know, if you'll look around and you want to find the people you think of as like you, right? And I think that's a very dangerous thing in itself. Because, you know, if we say, okay, we're all Buddhists here, how Buddhist do you have to be a Buddhist? Right? Are you Buddhist enough? You know, maybe we have to throw this guy out because he's just not Buddhist enough. See, at some point that becomes very dangerous, right? It's okay if everybody, I'm a Buddhist, no question about it. But does that mean Theravada people aren't Buddhists because they aren't my kind of Buddhist? Does that mean, what about somebody who's like a Chinese person who's a little bit of Taoist, a little bit of Buddhist, you know? Mixing it up. That's very Chinese to mix it up, right? Is that not pure Buddhism? You know, maybe that person isn't a real Buddhist. A real Buddhist is only a Buddhist. You know, we could go on like this for a long time. This is the problem with identity, right? This is the problem with identity. That you can never be Buddhist enough at some point, you know. You could be celibate, You could be live in a monastery. You could, you know, but you still might not be thinking Buddhist thoughts. So you're not really a Buddhist, right? And luckily in Buddhism, there haven't been these kinds of religious wars. They really have not happened. You know, and it's definitely the case if you look at like the history of some other religions, that, you know, really horrible religious conflicts over like these relatively trivial differences, and I think because of the spirit of Buddhism, that has never happened. You know, really, it's remarkable. But I think it hasn't happened because everybody still sort of remembers, oh yeah, the thing is that it's really about getting beyond identity. So you know, yes, you know, it's important to be something, right? But you know, watch out. Because, you know, the function of these should, you know, I look forward to the, you know, Tricycle Magazine asked a number of people who write for Tricycle Magazine to write about what being a Buddhist means to them. And they were especially interested in like what they were calling American Buddhism. And my view is there's no such thing as American Buddhism. I was born in America, but I don't believe there's an I don't even think there's a Chinese Buddhism. Chinese people have Buddhism and Tibetan people have, but I don't really think there's such a thing as Tibetan Buddhism, right? I think Buddhism is about leaving those things behind, is having those things as rafts and then leaving them behind. So I wrote something for Tricycle. I said something like, I was born in the United States, but I consider my homeland to be Magadha. And Magadha, I should explain, is the ancient Indian homeland of Buddhism. But it was destroyed, you know, 1800 years ago. And I said, you know, you won't find it on any map. You know, Magadha is in us. And Magadha isn't a place on a map. It's that place where identity disappears, where we forget the self and become one with the 10,000 things. And they didn't like it and they didn't publish that. So now, oh well, they wanted to talk about American Dharma. But if we understand the Dharma, we know there's no east and west and no north and south, right? There's just this. There's no Chinese and American or, you know, Sri Lankan and Tibetan. Those are merely conditional. We Buddhists don't, we followers of the Great Way don't take that seriously. Right? We understand those are, identity is just a raft to the transcendence of identity. And if we lose sight of that, we've lost everything. In fact, you know, we're not even human. Actually, human is just another label, right? We're not even human. This is from the early Buddhist sutras. The Buddha would, you know, he would get up early in the morning and do zazen, just like us, you know. And then he would eat his meal for the day. He only ate one meal, and in the afternoon he would offer teaching, and people would come to him and say, you know, help me, my mind is on fire, you know, this happened, and so on. And sometimes people would just come and ask questions. And somebody said, they were so impressed by his presence, right? Somebody said, you know, are you a human being? And the Buddha actually said, no. And the guy said, are you a god? And the Buddha said, no. And he said, what are you? And he said, I'm awake. A non-Buddhist said to the Buddha, I do not ask for words, I do not ask for non-words. The Buddha just sat there. The philosopher said admiringly, the world-honored one, with his great mercy, has blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the great way. After making bows, he took his leave. Then Ananda asked the Buddha, what did he realize to admire you so much? The world honored one replied, a fine horse runs even at the shadow of the crowd. In other words, you know, the horse knows that it's not about the crop. The horse doesn't need to see the crop. The horse just sees the shadow of the crop. He knows that these things we take for real are not real, right? And the point is to transcend the self, basically. It's sort of a metaphor. Mumon's comment. Ananda was the Buddha's disciple, and Ananda, by the way, was he had this super retentive mind. Every word the Buddha spoke, he could recall. But see, holding on to even the Buddha's words is not liberation. Ananda was the Buddha's disciple, but his understanding was not equal to that of the non-Buddhist,
right,
who's gone beyond words and beyond self. I want to ask you, what difference is there between the Buddha's disciple and the non-Buddhist? Mumon's verse, on the edge of a sword over the ridge of an iceberg, with no steps, no ladder, climbing the cliffs without hands,